The invitation to one of only four such events organized so far by the Nixon White House illustrated Cash's growing stature, and his comments on the war displayed a newly acquired gift for diplomacy. He simultaneously presented himself as thoroughly American, an outspoken supporter of the president, and a campaigner for peace. His refusal to sing Welfare Cadillac, not just because he hadn't written it, but because the song appeared to mock the poor, was widely reported and drew attention to his integrity. Here was a man who wouldn't compromise his art even for the holder of the highest office in the land. Cash's friendship with Billy and Ruth Graham grew stronger, and this too helped to establish him in the pantheon of great living Americans in the eyes of the watching public. Graham, after all, had been meeting major world dignitaries since the 1950s, and though living a life of modesty and humility, had enjoyed unparalleled access to those in power. When Ruth, Billy, and their son Ned spent Christmas with the Cashes in 1974, in the aftermath of the Watergate crisis, Graham put a call through to the then-disgraced former president. After wishing him the best for Christmas, he handed the phone to Cash and forced him into a conversation. Cash and Graham became close friends over the years, primarily maintaining their relationship through written correspondence. Their families would visit one another at the Cashes' home in Hendersonville, the Grahams' home in Montreat, or at the Cashes' vacation home in Jamaica. These times were important to both families in keeping their personal and spiritual lives refreshed. Montreat, North Carolina, 28757, January 7th, 1975. My dear Johnny and June, words are inadequate to express our appreciation for one of the most marvelous weeks of our lives. When we left, Ruth and I had tears in our eyes, not only of appreciation, but affection for the two of you and your wonderful family. We have come to love you all as few people we have ever known. The fun we had, the delicious food we ate, the stimulating conversations, lying in the moonlight at night, the prayer meetings, the music we heard, etc. There has been running over and over in my mind Matthew 24 is knocking at the door. I have a feeling this could be a big hit. Please give our love to the staff and all those who made our stay so memorable, especially John Carter, who is one of the most remarkable little boys we have ever known. With warmest affection, Billy. Gardner Webb College, a small Baptist college in North Carolina, awarded Johnny an honorary doctorate in humanities. The citation, read by the chairman of the college's board of trustees, referred to him as one of the princes of American country music, and conferred the doctorate for his humanitarian activities on behalf of the humble and the poor, those who are the victims of drugs and alcohol, and the thousands locked behind prison walls. Accepting the award, Cash said, "Anything legislative bodies of the world may do, with all their speeches, is not worth 2 cents unless you care for people." Although he had performed for prisoners since 1957, the concept of Johnny Cash the humanitarian didn't develop until the 1970s when, in addition to his vocal concern for the welfare of prisoners, he committed random acts of generosity for the deserving poor and willingly spoke out about the dangers of addiction. Stories of his big-hearted gestures toward ordinary people found their way into the press, like the time he gave $10,000 to a Nashville man in desperate need of a kidney machine, or the phone call he made to a 12-year-old boy in Texas who had lost both his arms in a farming accident, or the $5,000 check he sent to the correction commissioner of Arkansas to do something special for the prisoners. With just a few steps, Cash the humanitarian became Cash the Great American. As early as 1972, committees set up to organize various celebrations for the bicentennial in 1976 recruited Cash. His statesmanlike qualities represented the best qualities of American life. Not only was he a family man, a patriot, and a military veteran, but he had overcome physical and spiritual hardship, rooted for the underdog, supported the president, and was a practicing Christian. The Spirit of America Festival gave him the Audie Murphy Patriotism Award. In a 1969 review of a Madison Square Garden concert, the New York Post pop critic Al Aronowitz made the prescient observation that Cash was bringing the country to the city with an authority that nobody else possesses in this fragmented nation. Johnny Cash knew how to talk to prisoners and to presidents. He knew, as a matter of fact, how to talk to all America. A naturally self-analytical man, Cash had long been interested in his identity as an American. His albums, True West, Bitter Tears, in blood, sweat, and tears, examined the nature of America and her people. As a traveling musician, he'd seen more of the American landscape than most, and he loved it all. The woodlands of Tennessee, the mountains of Virginia, the arid desert of California and Nevada, the cotton fields of Mississippi. He pored over books of American history, collected presidential autographs, and loved to dig up the spent bullets of Civil War soldiers and the arrowheads of Indian hunters. "This is my country," he once said, "and I'm proud of every inch of its soil." In 1974, he had made the TV special Riding the Rails, which writer-producer Diane Rifkin describes as being the story of the building of America as seen through the building of the railroad from 1880 up to the 1970s. The filming involved recreating many of the seminal moments in railroad history, allowing Cash to imaginatively enter his country's past. Johnny Cash made a great American icon, especially since, as Stan Jacobson observed when producing the Johnny Cash Show, he had the ability to unite the generations. Older people appreciated his military service, his gospel songs, and the success story of the boy from the cotton fields of Depression-era Arkansas who rose to sing to the president. Young people identified with the way he challenged authority, his protest songs, his inner questing, and his plea for peace at the White House. Cash never unconditionally approved of his country. When asked what made him the most proud of America, he said, "Our freedoms were won at a very high cost, and I think there's a lot to be said for a little flag waving in my country. You know, God bless America. I think God has blessed America, and I don't know how much longer he's going to go on blessing it the way we're screwing it up by getting involved in everybody's little battle. But the family unit, the home, our freedoms, that's what's precious. Then the pioneer spirit of America that still prevails in a lot of the country is precious to me. The spaciousness of the country. I love the West. The American West." In December 1970, he started work on a collection of songs about the most important events in American history. Originally, he planned to send a tape of them to the moon with astronaut Stu Russo on the Apollo 14 mission. He thought the songs would keep the astronauts' thoughts down to Earth while they were in space. The tape never made it on the mission, and Cash didn't pick up the project until June 1972, when, after recording three additional songs, he released America, a 200-year salute in story and song. The conventional and uncontroversial approach to American history highlighted Paul Revere, the Battle of New Orleans, the Alamo, the Gettysburg Address, the assassination of President Garfield, World War I, the advent of flight, and the moon landing. Cash's narration filled in the historical gaps. The one note of rebellion was the inclusion of Bigfoot, the song that he had written about Wounded Knee. Shortly after its release, Saul Holliff retired as Cash's manager, and Lou Robin replaced him. "Nobody could believe that anyone would voluntarily leave Johnny," says Holliff, "but I have the documentation to prove it." He had just come through being a superstar, and he was still a star. He was in good shape. He had quit smoking and had straightened himself up. He had a good marriage, and he adored his son. "However, I truly believe that it was going to be anticlimactic from then onward." And it was. For the next 10 or 12 years, he went into a tailspin until Columbia even reached the point where it dropped him.